What is the relationship between structure and form? Between knowing and the known?
We were just talking about this in linguistics, the noun and the verb.
Between that infinite force of creation that produces all the varieties of structure and form in evolution that we can trace back at least 4 million years as a continuum of variation and adaptation and cognition, that all of those forms and structures which we know, so to speak, and that which is, which doesn't change, but which is the life force of all of those structures and forms. What's the relationship between that so-called eternal or ever-present drive throughout hundreds of millions of years and all of the infinite varieties of structure and form that take place in time? It remains a mystery. That was the last observation that we made. It remains a mystery. The self, according to Sri Aurobindo's metaphysical and psychological understanding of existence, the self is that unchanging, ever-present spiritual force, and the infinite variety of structures and forms that unfold throughout time are the temporal manifestations of that. This was the theme of our last week's exploration, and it was very, very consistent from beginning to end. I listened to it recently, and I would recommend that anybody who wants to follow this course and really put your finger on the pulse of this course, you can easily go to the website and download last week's talk, which is number 6. And if you compare that, and you have to download it on your computer and then listen to it. You can't listen to it directly online. So you have to log into the website, download the audio file, and then listen to it. But it all happens very quickly. If you compare last week's talk with the last talk of the first session, which was number 12, you'll see a very interesting set of relationships and correspondences between the ideas in the two. The last one, number 12, last year, and number 6 last week. I think that they pretty much culminate the discussion that we're having. So it's easy to tune back into those talks just by downloading them. So the at the end of last week, what was the proposition that was formulated and expressed in the context of the whole hour, hour and a half, was that the self, which is to be realized in yoga through detachment and universalization of consciousness, can be known in things. Evolution can be known as the infinite expression of the self, if one's consciousness is universalized. This is Sri Aurobindo's philosophy of evolution. Scientists tend to focus on the structural changes in things, and we were just discussing in the last hour today, at the end, this idea that energy flows through structures in order to maintain those structures. Species or individuals are maintained by a process of energy flowing through them. The dissipation of energy maintains the form of the thing. You continue to be who you are throughout your life as a result of the dissipation of energy, without which you would crumble. But after a certain point, you don't change very much. You just continue being who you are, and the energy continues to flow through. And so with all species. The philosopher-physicist Ilya Prigozhin, in this time frame that we live in, has determined that this is the essential nature of life. Structure and form are maintained by a process of the dissipation of energy. Then, and this was also an idea that Spencer formulated 150 years ago. Herbert Spencer was the first philosopher of evolution, and he formulated the same idea. But now, in the physics of life, it is quite well established. Now, there are two other factors in the maintenance of life, according to a more synthetic philosophical view expressed by Fritz Capra. And we were discussing this in the last session today. What happens as a result of the dissipation of energy is that the self of the thing, or the form of the thing, is continually creating itself. You are continually creating yourself, and you are continually constructing knowledge as a result of energy flowing through the system. So Paul was asking this question about what are we about knowledge. It seems to understanding is the eating of mental energy, but at the same time that energy is being eaten, understanding is being constructed. So this is a theory of knowledge which is very popular in the world today, in philosophy and learning theory, and in biology. The being, or the entity, the exemplar of the species, is continually creating itself. And at the same time that it creates itself, it's also creating its environment. Every species is continually creating its environment. The third dimension of that process is information processing. At the same time that energy flows through the exemplar, And the exemplar is creating itself and its environment, that process of self-creation called autopoiesis is a process of cognition. Every energy transfer that happens between the individual and the environment, or inside the individual, in his own environment and himself, every moment of energy exchange of any kind is information. And so the biologists today, from the most ultra Darwinian to the most pluralistic pluralist, recognizes that information transfer is going on at the cellular level. It's going on all the time in all species. It has been going on since the first amoeboid cell processed a light ray and moved in the water as in response to the light ray. That information transfer is going on, and adaptation, the whole process of adaptation in nature and response to the environment and variation and selection, is a process of cognition. So it's understood today that life is this triangle of processes. Dissipation of energy that maintains a structure in its integrity over a long period of time. Self-creation of that integrity according to its body plan and its species type and what it has to become, its potential. And cognition, which is the continual stimulus and response and memory and nervous accumulation of patterns of behavior and selection among those patterns of behavior of what is good and what is bad, what Conrad Lorenz called, what did he call it? Does somebody remember? This process of cognition that allows us to recognize patterns, pattern recognition, which is going on all the time, he called the constancy mechanism. Every time there's an experience that recurs, it is related to a previous similar experience in the organism. The organism learns to recognize different environments, different stimuli, because of this constancy mechanism, otherwise known as generalization of experience, which is inherent in every organism. It's called learning also. Learning is possible because of a subconscious cellular mechanism that Conrad Lorenz called the constancy mechanism. So it allows every species to know after some time how to recognize an environment that it finds favorable and how to avoid an environment that it finds disfavorable. And the more experience an organism has, the better it gets at organizing its life. And so species become adapted to habitats because they become very familiar, and the species' behavior in those habitats becomes economical and allows the species to be well adapted. And there are innumerable scientific studies of the ability of species at all levels to learn from repeated exposures to experience and to remember those experiences and to behave according to what species learn.
But what we are telling now, it's more than because I was irritated that you said everything creating the environment. I think by a lot, most of animals, they react or adapt to the environment, but they don't create it, because environment-changing environment.
Well, according to biological understanding today, and here's a whole book full of recent observations about how animals create their environment. rabbits transported to Australia and hares transported to Australia created two different kinds of environments because of their interaction with those environments. They eat certain things in the environment which prevent other things from living in that environment anymore. And what they eat and what they defecate creates an ecological pattern that makes it impossible for other species to compete with them. Whereas when they first came into those environments, there were many different kinds of ecosystems going on. Beavers in ponds create pools, and in those pools there start to be various microorganisms and plants and so on. And after some two or three generations, the beaver family completely reorganizes the ecosystem of the whole lake in which they live by building dams and creating water flows. And we, obviously, we plant trees and we cut down trees and we create our whole global environment according to our choices about foods that we like and spaces that we want to inhabit and spaces that we don't want to inhabit. And so our species has completely changed the ecosystem of the earth, and but all species do that continually. The chemical processes in the environment of a species are a function of that species life cycle. And so the fertilization of the forest as a result of the massive termite processing of leaves on the floor of the forest creates a forest ecosystem. The termite is not just eating the leaves because it's hungry. It's eating the leaves in order to provide a fertile basis for the trees to grow. It doesn't know that, of course, but but that's just I think a good example. The termites are a good example of how insects create their environment, and then they live in and build their colonies out of the material that they're processing, and many other creatures benefit from that processing of leaves that they do. So insects, now it's a big problem in rainforests that cutting down of trees is destroying an ecosystem that was made by the species that inhabit that forest. So when you remove one species, you start to undermine the whole ecosystem. And eventually, after a few thousand species are destroyed in a rainforest, life is very difficult for anything.
I have a question. You were talking before about energy, and I felt for me it was not specific enough what you mean by energy. Is it the energy of Einstein?
I'm talking about biology now, food processing, carbon.
Energy in general, when you talk about energy, can you specify?
Yeah, I just specified. Eating carbohydrates is processing life energy. And using that energy economically to procreate and to build a habitat in which it's possible to live safely is a utilization of the energy that is being processed by the organism. And as that organism processes energy to nourish and procreate, it also creates substances in the environment and takes substances out of the environment that alter the nature of the environment itself. And that alteration which takes place is not necessarily destructive. Bees pollinate flowers and make for themselves more potentials for processing honey, and it helps the flowering kingdom when they do that. So, nature is made up of living organisms, and the definition that is now popular among philosophers of biology and philosophers of physics is a threefold definition. Life is a combination of dissipation of energy to maintain consistency or cohesion or coherence in a body, the self-creation of that body continually through the dissipation of energy, and the learning and information exchange which takes place in that process.
So then you can say the learning or cognition it's a phenomenon of consciousness in life?
Yeah. Cognition is exactly that. And we've covered in the last previous 12 sessions and some sessions here, we've covered many, many, many examples from Conrad Lorenz of how cognition takes place through behavior. Behavior itself produces consciousness. So, Then last week I put on the board something called the Four Dimensions of Evolution. And spoke a little bit about each one of them. Genetic, epigenetic, behavioral, and symbolic variation. These are tools for identifying with natural processes. The presumption is that if we detach ourselves from sensations, perceptions, preferences, learned, conditioned responses, opinions, and dogmas, and allow our consciousness to step away from those patterns of behavior that we normally identify with as ourselves, according to Sri Aurobindo, it becomes possible then to be conscious universally, of universal nature, of universal mind, of universal processes of cognition, of learning that is going on at every instant in ourselves and in the environment around us, and to impersonally be conscious of the natural world, nature, capital N, the mother, to be in her consciousness, and not to be identified with our own immediate preoccupations, ideas, preferences, values, feelings, judgments, and so on. And he says that we can learn to be in that universal consciousness all the time. And then the center of action shifts. It shifts away from the person into universal nature. and it allows universal thought forms to descend. And these are not abstract thoughts, but mind is universal. So the knowing of things as they are, that's what I mean by universal thought forms. The knowing of things as they are becomes accessible to our radar. And then we see, for example, as the example that we've used several times, we can see something like the spirit of healing manifesting in people's behavior everywhere, especially healers and doctors who are working in hospitals everywhere all the time, but caring about each other and taking care of ourselves and being conscious of a universal spirit of healing and bringing to well-being of ourselves and our neighbors and our planet. We can become conscious of learning as a continuous, ever-present, ongoing phenomenon in nature, and especially in human nature, so that even when we make the stupidest mistakes, we don't have to react and get angry with ourselves or get angry with somebody else because they are malevolent, evil beings. If we see that they are just as much in a process of learning as we are, and not just think that, but know universally the energy of learning, of processing and adapting and adjusting and being better at who we are and allowing others to be better at who they are. And this is ongoing every moment. It only requires, it's a reality. This is not an abstraction. This is not how it ought to be. This is how it is. We don't see that because we're preoccupied with sensations and perceptions and ideas and opinions and judgments and needs and all kinds of things around which we turn all the time, which preoccupy us. So yoga is about detaching from all of those things. They continue to go on. You detach your consciousness from all of those things, but nature is what those things are. So they continue going, but with less of a attachment on our part. So the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo is that the self can step back from all of those aspects of its nature. Those aspects of nature continue to go on in us and everybody, but that self can tune in to a higher level of all of those things which are going on. The universal thought, truth, energy, nature of all of those things. And then once the self begins to identify with that larger perspective, a higher consciousness than that even can descend, called the illumined mind. And that is a more energetic, luminous seeing of everything. Not only understanding everything in terms of universal forms, but actually participating subtly in the energization of everything to become what it is. And then beyond that, a higher level of consciousness can descend. And he means not just descend into our radar, but actually descend into ourselves so that we become inspired, luminous energy fields that are pumping pure consciousness all the time, without any sense of being a separate self. So he says that these higher levels of consciousness can now descend if we perform that yogic reduction and aspire for that, and keep ourselves empty and calm, and remember, and expand and open to that other totality, then these other energies of knowing and being and doing can begin to flow in us. And then we attune ourselves to the creativity of the universe. We become evolutionary beings like that. So the proposition was that we can move progressively from a learned awareness of nature as a learning, knowing, caring, adapting field that we are part of, and that includes everything that's living, and the same processes are going on in everything that's living. And there are, we've talked about dozens of examples of how our behavior is pretty much the same as most other species' behavior. It's just a little bit more human, but basically the same. So then we can progressively move from that larger awareness of the totality of nature in itself, not nature as we like to think of it or have learned about it, but how it is, to an illumined participation in nature, to an intuitive, creative, luminous energizing of nature as a way of being. Like now our way of being is mental and vital and foolish and inefficient, and that there it can become all-knowing and luminous and untiring and a manifestation of higher planes of consciousness. A manifestation of higher planes of consciousness, not just an ascent into higher levels of consciousness. Sri Aurobindo says that that's the point to which evolution has now come. When we were backtracking through 400 million years of evolution, the question was, can we understand that whole period of infinite variation and adaptation and speciation and interrelation as the movement of an eternal spiritual being that whose mission is to unfold life forms for its pleasure, for its joy, for its self-expression infinitely, and its only restriction is the constraint of the physical environment. Every species is constrained by the physical environment. Temperature and pressure and availability of food and competition and so on. So species adapt to a niche in which they function harmoniously until that can no longer be done, and then they move, and under new circumstances there are variations that occur genetically, and there are variations that can occur epigenetically, that is through chemical interactions with the environment. That's epigenetic. It's like the chemicals and the structures are there, but different chemicals in the environment stimulate different responses in the system, and so different manifestations occur chemically as a result of the environment and not genetically. And then behaviors which are learned or behaviors which are inherited influence the environment, and when behaviors change, then species change. For example, I just read in Jablanka, I think that's a good Polish Jewish name, Jablanka. these are a couple of Israeli biologists, Jablanka and Lamb. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. They have all kinds of stories about how species learn new behaviors and then their whole way of life changes. For example, there's a species of rat that lives around Jerusalem and survives upon waste. Some members of this species moved into a nearby pine forest where rats don't live and learned how to shell the pine nuts. And the biologists discovered that these pine nuts were getting eaten and there were no squirrels. And so they started to observe very closely, and they found that the pine nuts were peeled by the rats in a very systematic spiral way. And they took some of these rats and observed them closely, and only the offspring of a rat who knows how to peel a pine nut could peel a pine nut. No other rats could peel the pine nuts. And so some rats had learned how to peel these pine nuts and had taught that to their offspring. And the way they taught their offspring was not through imitation. That was what they mainly wanted to show. It was not an imitative behavior. It was a genuine learning behavior. The parent rat would start the spirals and then give the pine nut to the young, whose teeth would move in those spirals, and that way the young learned to peel the whole nut. Then these rats started living in pine trees and making their nests in pine trees. And that species of rat was never known to have eaten pine nuts or lived in trees. So a whole new subspecies of black rat moved out of Jerusalem and set up habitat in the pine forest and taught their young how to do that.
Probably occupied territory. Was there any record of speciation and inability?
Not yet. This is a new phenomenon. So, yes.
Did they move out of need, or did they move by accident?
Yeah, it must have been out of need.
Yeah.
I mean, they must have felt pressure, you know. And now another thing that they have learned on the genetic level. They really go into detail into genetic, epigenetic, behavioral, and symbolic evolution. Because here we see an example of evolution which is not genetic at all. It's purely learned traditional or cultural behavior, which changes a whole species' habitat and life. Okay? There are several examples of that. So they want to make the point that this is a Darwinian process, but it is not genetic. It's not being determined genetically. It's being determined through learning and transmitted through learning. So,
sorry that the story of the penguins, I don't know if you know, but penguins started a new behavior in another place. And they didn't know about each other, they had also the same new behavior, although they were not the offspring of each other.
Right. So there are many ways to explain that. We find in the human world that people all over the world are changing at the same time, in the same way, and learning things. So there are many explanations for that. They're not mysterious at all. They're very pragmatic. So, on the genetic level, there are numerous experiments now, according to these people, to show that under stress, chemical biochemical genetic processes are activated under stress, which make mutation much more common. So whereas a genome is very stable for thousands of generations, there are no mutations that are significant, under severe stress, all species have acquired a genetic behavior, a genetic pattern, that they become more mutable. And so the shrews, for example, that I was referring to last time, after the extinction of the dinosaurs and the tremendous climatic changes which occurred on the Earth, these little mammals that inhabited many different niches apparently became very adaptable, and within a relatively short period of time, the mammal kingdom exploded. Just thousands of new species of mammals evolved in a relatively short period of time after the Jurassic and in the Cretaceous period, when mammals became dominant. Mammals had never, only small mammals existed, not very many mammals existed, and they were the food of dinosaurs. So lizards existed, big lizards. Dinosaurs. They go further back. So the dinosaurs came from lizards that lived in the sea, and they came from fish and so on. And we can now trace all of these body plans and even genetically trace the links of all of these species. So that's why we know that shrews were base for the evolution of mammals, including primates. And they diversified very rapidly into many niches, holes in the ground, trees, lakes, and they just started living everywhere, and their bodies started to evolve. And shrews continued to be shrews, but because in the beginning they were egg-laying. Shrews were marsupials. And so in between being egg-laying mammals and regular mammals, many, many changes took place, over millions of years, no doubt, but not so many millions of years as it took for dinosaurs to evolve, or for those that I showed you, that little lizard with the tail, with the sail. And if you look at the change between that guy, this is the time frame that I was showing you last time. From 4 million to 1 million years, there were all these different periods of time where completely different species evolved that hadn't existed before. And then during the Cretaceous, between the beginning of the Cretaceous and the Quaternary, when human beings took place, was a relatively short period of time. And 1.6 million years ago is when the first hominids stood up, Homo erectus. So anyway, if you look at these guys that we looked at last time, this shrew on the left is a monotreme. He was a very early mammal. This tree shrew was a later mammal. But if you compare this monotreme with that first little guy 300 million years before him, who has been proven to be a precursor of mammals, this guy, this sail, this fin, which would belong to a fish before he got it, now he's a quadruped walking on the land. He still has a fin, which is used to modulate body temperature. So you compare him to this guy with fur and long quills, this marsupial monotreme. He still has those fins, and they're still used to control body temperature, just like hair is on the other guy. But now they are something else. Now they're quills. They're not a sail anymore, and they're not yet hair. And eventually mammals are mainly known for being covered by hair. And so he's moving in that direction. And he's been moving in that direction for 400 million years since that first little quadruped came up onto land. You know, so these, we can trace many, many patterns of adaptation through structure. So we ended up last week by pointing out that scientists are very preoccupied with structure, because if you take into consideration the changes in structure that come from genes, the changes that come from epigenetic chemical interactions.
Where does this come from? The first I've heard of it is what? Epigenetic.
What?
That changes in genes can come within my body or the body without reproduction.
No, but I didn't say that. I said if you take into consideration all the genetic changes in structure that come about, and all of the changes in structure that come about epigenetically, and all the changes in structure that come about behaviorally, and finally in human beings symbolically, you know, like she gives an... Okay, let's don't take a sidetrack. Let's stay on this for a moment. There are so infinitely many patterns of variation structurally that scientists who are clear-headed, calm, and observant human beings can easily spend a lifetime studying structural patterns.
Did you ever tell the class about the beak of the finch, where there's a small...
I haven't.
Yeah.
There's an excellent book about the adaptation of finches, called The Beak of the Finch. It's the observed changes within a few families' lifetimes of shapes of beaks, which come about just as a response to environmental changes. So there's a direct transfer of environmental pressure to genetics. But it's not necessarily a genetic change, because I've discussed before how the genome has a certain plasticity, and there are many possibilities that are made possible by the genome that aren't necessarily activated by the environment. So under different circumstances, frogs, for example, have different colors and shapes and reproduction patterns just by changing their temperature and humidity in their cage. So then philosophers, on the other hand, are very preoccupied with form, not with structure. Philosophers think about general patterns, species, generalizations, principles. So we philosophers can spend a lifetime, just like scientists spend a lifetime looking at structures, we can spend a lifetime looking at patterns, general patterns, like good and evil, and democracy and capitalism and communism, and stages of the psychological development of societies, archaic and mythic and magical and religious and rational. And we can identify all kinds of forms in life, and even psychic being and higher mind and over mind and super mind. You know, these are big concepts, big general concepts that we just love to play with. Spirit, you know, Hegel and spirit and the reason behind everything. Societies produce art and all the different forms of art that they produce and what this tells us about the human spirit. I mean, philosophers love this kind of thing. And never think about the underlying biochemical processes that are going on. And you know, Sri Aurobindo uses this example of Shakespeare and Hamlet, and he makes a poem, which is a kind of joke, about how the genes and chromosomes of Shakespeare produced Hamlet. You know? Well, he got that idea from William James. He read a book by William James in the early part of the century, around 1900, called The Principles of Psychology, in which William James uses exactly that image to make a contrast between science and psychology and philosophy. And Sri Aurobindo, in one of his letters, says he got many good ideas from William James, and that's obviously one of them, because it's verbatim. He takes it right from William James and uses it in the Life Divine, in the early Life Divine in 1920. So this is a good example. William James was one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century, and Sri Aurobindo was one of the other ones. And there were a couple of others, not very many, really great philosophers, but all of them are preoccupied with ethics. You know, what's the meaning of ethics, good behavior and bad behavior, and how does it form societies? And I have said many times that human society, human civilization, is primarily, essentially, social and ethical. The big difference between human behavior and society and animal behavior is that humans have become 100% social, and all of their social behavior is a function of their ability to make choices for the good of the whole, and to make sacrifices, for personal sacrifices, for the good of the whole. And that's what laws are all about, and religious, social, behavior patterns that enable people to get married and to not seduce each other's husbands, and for families to take care of the bride or the groom, and you know, all of there's a big ritual around all of that, because it gives society consistency and safety and harmony. So whether you're looking at magical society or mythical society or religious or rational or
Taliban.
I mean, why do you think they wear veils and wrap their heads in turbans, you know? It's just ethical behavior. And ethical behavior is surprisingly capable of brutality for the sake of the group, you know, and it's not unethical. St. Augustine wrote a lot in The City of God about how war is justified. And it has become a counter, you know, like a pillar of the Christian faith, that war is an entitlement that Christians have received, that is essential for maintaining the well-being of the society under certain kinds of dire conditions. Not that, I mean, he wasn't as extreme as Muhammad, but Muhammad came along just about 100 years later, after Augustine, and thought that it was not only an entitlement, but a duty. So, it's ethical, and all human society is fundamentally ethical, whether it's magical or mythical or religious or rational or whatever. Human behavior is essentially, characteristically ethical. Now, if we look at the philosophers of today, and especially the philosophers of biology, as I've pointed out several times, they recognize that the human being today is able to make choices for the sake of the survival of the species that are detrimental to the survival of the individual. So women can choose to have fewer children. Governments can require women to limit the number of offspring. People with genius can sacrifice their family life and their personal ambitions, like the Dalai Lama, for the sake of the well-being not only of their own class of people and society of people and bloodline, but for humanity as a whole. And this kind of behavior, if we take Sri Aurobindo as an example, the behavior of someone who sits alone in a room for 40 years writing mantric poetry for the sake of transformation of humanity is making a huge, huge sacrifice. And because of their example, we learn symbolically how to change our own, not only social, but psychological and neurological pattern of behavior, because that example conveys to us the necessity to do that in order for the species to evolve beyond its current self-destructive limitations. And we take it to heart, we feel it, we resonate with it, and we commit ourselves to some kind of unusual pattern of behavior, mostly misunderstood among humanity as a whole, and easily characterized as religious fanaticism. But why we do it is because we get a transmission from a yogi who did it that helps us understand that that is a path to the future, and that if that higher consciousness can really be integrated in life, it can significantly impact humanity as a whole. Not that we have any very shiny examples of that yet, but somehow, because of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother, we know that it is a possibility. So evolution has now become 100% symbolic. And mantra is a very good example of how symbols carry not only information, they carry energy. And that energy can shift the behavior of a whole species of human beings, subspecies, and maybe species.
Rod?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I read The Economist, the magazine The Economist, every week comes to us there. And this week, and I haven't read it yet, that there is a worldwide pattern of falling fertility. That naturally, with the pressure of, you know, too many children and so on, somehow God, I mean, it all is to be analyzed, I don't know, but it was their cover.
I assure you, God has nothing to do with this.
Well,
God loves sex.
Some, whatever, I don't know the details and how it's being done and you know, there was something worldwide phenomenon, according to this.
Yeah, it's a trend towards extinction.
Yeah.
Yes, no, it's undoubtedly a trend towards extinction. And we are in the midst of what biologists have been recognizing for 40 years as a massive extinction event. 30% of vertebrate species became extinct in the last 25 years. Vertebrate species. We are a part of those, chordates. You know? This is not a joke. When we talk about, you know, oil economics and the growing gap between the rich and the poor and overpopulation and all of those things, we are speaking symbolically about a very pressing reality that it's being reflected in at all levels, including fertility rates. Overpopulation is a reality, and it is causing the extinction of vertebrate species, and it's rapid. So this is not hypothetical, and some people are very sensitive to it, and some people are completely immune to the idea and want to just keep on keeping on with the old patterns. Well, so we have at the Sri Aurobindo end of the spectrum, we have active evolutionary behavior trying to go on, and at the George Bush end of the spectrum, we have active anti-evolutionary behavior going on. Him and the Taliban, they belong in the same bag, you know. And so the human species is at a very critical moment. And the really smart human beings who've been analyzing the problem for 30 or 40 years are telling us in very, very substantive language that we have maybe 50 years to change things, at the end of which there is either going to be a leveling off or a rapid decline in living conditions. We can make certain changes in the next 50 years that would allow a leveling off, but this means that a lot of societies which are already up here are still going to experience a significant drop, while many societies can move into that leveling off. India's is one of those, but nobody's making a move in that direction. They're just cranking it up as fast as they can crank it up so that they can enjoy the fall when it gets to that point. The divine enjoys everything. So even the fall can be enjoyed by the divine. And the gods, as Sri Aurobindo tells us in Ilian very powerfully, the gods are not moved by joy and sorrow, by success and failure. The gods are those powers that just keep pumping in the energy, the delight, the drive, the push, the seeking, the opening, the experiencing. All of that energy which we've been calling nature can as well be called over-mental beings.
Right. So then what will happen, or what might happen, is with the environment being destroyed and then humanity 50 years from now coming to that point of stress, will be more open to mutation.
Definitely, no doubt. I mean, that's that we're already more open to mutation than any previous type of humanity that is known, that we know of. And the more extreme things become, the more open to mutation we get, not because we are spiritually enlightened, but because it's in ourselves. That evolution itself has built in the mechanism that under stress all species become more susceptible to variation on a genetic level. We can add to that a spiritual intelligence that brings that supramental force in contact with that opening genetic level and brings about more total, rapid alterations in the species. That's the idea of descent. You know, people keep wanting to hear this word descent because that sort of reinforces your religious understanding of things. But the idea of descent is that supermind, mind, life, matter are on a plane always there pressing, and the mind has become totally integrated in life, and supermind was always there pressing, but only now is it possible for supermind to descend into life through mind, because there is this greater adaptivity in the species that is the result of this whole long process. And you will notice that it has become shorter and shorter. Quaternary, 1.6 million years. Homo heidelbergensis, 600.6 million years. Neanderthal is 0.4. Homo sapiens, 0.15. That's only 150,000 years. Homo sapiens sapiens, 0.05. And yet, this guy has occupied all the niches on Earth and has mastered energy systems and utilized them like no other species ever remotely dreamed. And then we've got archaic man, who enjoyed something like somewhere between 160,000 to 40,000 years of life, and then magical man enjoyed only 30,000 years of life and was replaced by mythical man, and mythical man enjoyed a few thousand years, but he was replaced by religious man, who only enjoyed about 2,500 years, and then rational man came along and has so far enjoyed about 500 years of full-on activity. And so then the big question is, will this guy find a niche before the other guy brings it all down?
I really want to understand something. I read the paper that you gave at the beginning of this class, which was the introduction, I think, from your previous course. In that paper, I understood that this business of learning behavior, if the essential tools are there. I remember reading that behavior which is learned can actually be passed on genetically. I'm getting to the point of the fact that we have these examples, the mutation that is necessary to save humanity, for the Lord to do that, mutation that will come under the stress of this period will be because some people have managed to do this thing. What is the principle of it being able to genetically?
Okay, let me answer your question. Yeah. This book is all about that. Because these biologists are discovering more and more cases, because they're looking for them, because they're not taboo anymore as they were 100 years ago. They're discovering more and more cases of behavior being passed on at four different levels and not at the same time necessarily. So human society has been learning through symbolic communication and has changed many things from back here in the archaic up to here. The human being himself hasn't changed very much in that time genetically, but all the changes have happened on the phenotypic level. Now, but she has found quite a few examples of animals that pass on a tradition, like the black rat, let's say, hypothetically.
The hundred monkey.
Let me just follow this line. Take the black rat, for example, who starts building nests in trees. Now, she compares that to the phenomenon of squirrels that started out certain species of squirrels that started out living on the ground and in the end became flying squirrels. So take the shrew as an example. If shrews really were early mammals that became primates as a result of living in trees, the shrew didn't become a primate, but they were mutations that went on in the shrew species that branched off as a result of living in trees. So the way evolution works, apparently, according to them, is if a behavior pattern is passed on and it brings about an adaptation to a new environment, then there are certain genetic changes that go on all the time that have a chance of producing an individual that is more efficient in that environment than all the others. So the shrew, some shrews get born which have a little bit better grasping musculature just as a result of spontaneous mutation. And because they're living in trees, those guys with a stronger musculature survive and reproduce better than the other ones who are living in the trees but not having such a good time doing it. They're mainly there because they've learned how to eat the fruit. So then those who biogenetically reproduce better grasping mechanisms reproduce themselves more successfully, and so then there eventually comes about a whole species of shrews who are well adapted, not just phenotypically, but genetically well adapted to that environment. So the genetic process is not a direct transfer of a learned behavior to the genes. It's a learned behavior that becomes a pattern that genetic mutation supports. It selects. You know, some members of the species that are doing that new behavior do it more efficiently because of genetic mutation and because of epigenetic chemical adjustments. And so speciation takes place very slowly over a long period of time. So Sri Aurobindo is saying that it's possible for some human beings already, because of the elasticity of the genotype, some human beings, like yogis, can already become channels of that new energy, as he and the mother demonstrated. And we don't know how many there are who are capable of doing that, but theoretically, if you have groups of people who are practicing it, more and more will turn up who are capable of doing it under our present genetic structure. And he says that once you get a society made of people who develop that yogic consciousness, a Gnostic society, which is made up of Gnostic individuals who are transformed human beings, then it starts to become possible to see genetic shifts and the change in the structure of the human being. So that he says in that book called The Mind of Light, which is or called The Supramental Manifestation, that if there comes about a subspecies of human beings who are illumined, then they can be the link to a supramental species which would not necessarily breathe the same way that we do, would not necessarily digest food the same way that we do. But that kind of genetic mutation he puts very far away, and he puts in an intermediate period of time that's indeterminate the possibility of superhuman beings who would deliberately integrate the supramental force and allow it to work in them instead of the mind working in them and the vital working in them, because it's capable of the same things that the mind and the vital do, but doing them better. So we have to be convinced to allow that those higher planes of energy and consciousness to do in us what we already do as a result of our already achieved evolution, and to gradually transform the quality of life, not the structures of life. It says in Savitri, as a result of her change, everything was the same as before, but different, you know. So that "but different" is what we have to learn, and how that brings about structural change belongs to the future. And Sri Aurobindo said he's not going to say very much about that, but it could mean changing the way we breathe and the way we process food and so on. And reproduction might become a direct materialization from the subtle physical to the material. But that's speculative.
Well, can it be similar, seeing liberate? Now, what does it mean that, so evolution is a combination of those forces, the genetic, the epigenetic, the behavioral. What's exactly the symbolic? How does it work?
Okay. Language evolved sometime around 50,000 years ago. And not just spoken language, but symbolic language, drawing on rocks, indicating how the hunt was going to be organized. As soon as human beings started making sounds that corresponded to actions and remembering the association between those sounds and those actions, they began to become more efficient and better organized. So today, I asked you last time, is this guy also part of that sphere of consciousness? And you said, I think so, but I'm not sure how, or something like that. Obviously, today, this instrument is an extension of consciousness, and it enables human beings to organize energy in the form of petrodollars all over the planet instantaneously. So this level of symbolic autopoiesis, self-creating, and cognition is universal already. It was never universal before. There were always societies that had their languages and their cultural patterns that they used to shape their environment and to shape the quality of life and to pass on from generation to generation behavior patterns that were closely associated to animals and food and animal husbandry. And so with animal husbandry, take the Egyptians, for example, with their civilization. They were so well attuned to the river and the animals and the crops that they were able to survive beautifully for 5,000 years. And they believed in immortality, and they practiced immortality. You know, for them it was just the same spirit going through all the motions. So that was all done symbolically. They had good language and number skills and organizational skills, all of which allowed them to function symbolically, but that symbolic functioning ordered the whole biosphere. And they produced many new species, and they tamed them, and they bred them, and
they mummified them by thousands.
Not the new species.
They put them in
tombs. They preserved them.
National Geographic this country.
Okay, they preserved things, and they preserved knowledge preeminently, and passed it on, and passed technique along. And they had their artisans were excellent, and they could do miracles with nature. And so that was all done symbolically. Clear enough? How do animals use symbolism? Yablanka gives the example of Japanese monkeys that were experimented with by scientists. They were brought to the scientists wanted to observe their learning behavior, and especially their assimilation of symbols and language. So they moved a bunch of them down to the seaside because it was too difficult to observe them in the forest. And as a reward for cooperating and staying on the beach, they gave them sweet potatoes. One really smart monkey found that the sweet potato was all covered with dirt and went to the riverside, which came into the sea there, and cleaned the sweet potato in the water, and did this a few times, and other monkeys around watched her doing this, and they all learned how to clean the sweet potatoes. And then after some time, and they just learned this by themselves, and they shared the pattern, and they could pass it on by example easily. It was easily learned. And then they started washing the sweet potatoes in the seaside, and then they started playing in the surf, these monkeys that had never lived on the beach before, and they learned how to swim. And they passed on swimming skills to their progeny. And after the scientists moved away and more generations of monkeys were created, they were all still washing their food in the river and swimming in the sea. And so this shows how a kind of tradition gets passed on, which is not genetic, it's not necessary for survival. The playing in the seaside and all of those things were acquired through learning, and it became a culture of monkeys enjoying living on the sea.
Because behavior is need driven, behavior changes, it's symbolic, not necessary.
In this case, it wasn't need driven at all, yeah. It was just spontaneous learning behavior.
This is the 100 monkey story, right?
No.
It's the one I know.
Similar to that one?
No, it is that. It's from Japan. It is that.
Well, maybe.
That a monkey started washing, just what you described.
Okay, yeah, maybe.
The swimming business is in addition to it. But spontaneously, after a large number had learned how to do it, they all did it. It became culture.
Yeah, so they do it, but it's not genetically determined.
No.
But what Yablanka says is that when behaviors like that get learned, it's possible for genetic changes to support those behaviors. So in certain environmental conditions, which you can imagine, and there are all kinds of experiments that scientists refer to, you could imagine more extreme conditions where it was a necessity to do that, and where dolphins, for example, were mammals, and then they went back into the sea and lost their feet. But it's well known that at some point they were also shrews. You know, they were also some kind of a pig-like creature that under certain circumstances had to go back into the sea. And they have learned, living in the sea, to make sounds, and they teach each other sounds, and they can be taught sounds. You know, they have this ability to learn language which other sea creatures don't have, because it's mammals that mainly learned that. And so birds have learned how to teach their offspring a slight variation in their mating songs which other very similar birds don't make. They've learned another pattern. And so this brings about a reproductive isolation of certain birds who know those sounds. And therefore, they will have a genetic pool after some time that's different from the genetic pool of those birds that use that other sound, because it's sex-linked. And then that group of birds may develop a slight variation in color. They may also develop a variation in eating patterns through reproducing just among themselves, because they have that song which they have propagated. So there you get symbolic behavior, which is to attract a mate through sound, which doesn't attract those mates because they've learned another song, and then genetic changes start coming about as a substratum of the symbolic behavior. So apparently there are many behaviors in animals that are sex-linked, that have to do with mating practices that eventually lead to shifts in the genome.
What about this morphogenetic field? Morphogenetic field, where they say the story was ahead, they say on an island where these monkeys didn't have a contact with the monkeys who were on to wash the containers. After some time, also on this island, the monkeys started to wash the containers.
That's what he was calling attention to. But why does there have to be a morphogenic field?
This is what it's saying.
Why can't it just be one monkey watching another one?
No, there is no contact.
What she says is that they just learned faster.
No, in a different geographic location, they also picked it up.
That's not in this story.
What you said before was the Gnostic society.
But there it's a direct transmission, mantra. Sri Aurobindo has initiated a Gnostic evolution through mantra. And no one's going to learn that who doesn't come into direct contact with it. Take it from me.
Evolution, there is a morphogenic field, because if you look at human societies, for example, when they domesticated animals on different continents, they did it at more or less the same time, completely separate from each other. They discovered these things relevant to their own environments. So that something was in
I don't think anything has to be in the atmosphere. That can be genetic, because we know that from looking at Pangaea, we know that the basic genetic structure of all species is the same. And so just because you have an isolation taking place and you have variations happening that aren't happening somewhere else, still, the basic genetic structures are there. And so, under various environmental conditions, structures emerge.
It's just behavior patterns also.
And behavior patterns and so on. Whether or not we can take up Sheldrake's book if you want. I have a copy of his book, and you can buy it easily here too. It's called it's his main one about morphogenetic fields, and it's Remembrance of the Past, or
Sheldrake?
Yeah, Rupert Sheldrake. Yeah, he's written a couple of books about morphogenic fields, and the main one is called The Recurrence of the Past, or something like that. And his theory is that there's a kind of subtle memory from generation to generation, somewhat like reincarnation, that enables the body, when a limb is cut off, to keep functioning as if the limb was there. And once a behavior is learned, it's passed on, not genetically, but it's passed on also not behaviorally, but subtly passed on by a subtle energy formation that stays in the atmosphere.
So that you could call symbolic?
No, I wouldn't call that symbolic. I would call that subtle physical.
So the subtle physical?
A symbol is something other than what it is. You know, it's like Akhenaten made the sun a symbol of the liberated human spirit. And he also liberated the slaves, and he liberated Moses and all of that. So higher mind or illumined mind was symbolized by the sun, but the behavior of Akhenaten was the behavior of somebody who has tuned in to the illumined mind. So Sri Aurobindo's mantric poetry is symbolic, energetic, illumined mind field that gets transmitted through images and sound. That's symbolic. But the actual illumined mind field is something that we tune into and we start integrating as an energy. So Savitri is the symbolic link with that.
There's an older idea
of the subtle physical, you say, this intermediary being, it's not what you're talking about now, but you spoke about some 10 minutes ago. The subtle physical which takes on material form, or...
That was not the intermediate being. That was the direct manifestation of the supramental being.
Oh, and the intermediary being would be somebody...
Would be the Gnostic yogi like Sri Aurobindo.
Okay. But by the subtle physical you mean the psyche?
No.
It's really the subtle physical, whatever that means.
There's a canto in Savitri all about it.
Yeah.
It's the second canto of book two.
Rod, this karma has...
And the second canto of book two is all about morphogenic fields.
Does karma, which has many different aspects of beliefs and dogmas, etc., etc., about it there, but is there any form of karma which is involved in this patterns that you've been talking about?
That question is much too vague to even try to answer.
Cause and effect.
I don't know what you mean by karma.
That's exactly it, because this one's karma, this Buddhist karma, and that karma.
So there's Sri Aurobindo has a chapter in the Life Divine called Rebirth and what's it called? I can look it up here, but Karma and Rebirth. Yeah, that's it. Karma and Rebirth. Excellent chapter. Covers the whole subject completely.
Thank you. Very good.
For thousands of years, there have been Homo sapiens, who have been able to take instruction from non-physical teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, that trend is...
Nothing new about that.
There's nothing new about that. But that plus the mantra,
mantra has always been around also.
Yes.
And it was for you've been used for different purposes at different times.
But people in this room are also, many people in this room have experienced instruction from me.
So what I believe is that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have initiated a process of physical transformation that is unique and specific. And the mantra is exactly for that purpose, and that purpose alone, and there was never one like it before. Although the principle of mantra has been there forever and used for different purposes. The Vedic mantras were used to enlighten the Vedic seers, but it wasn't used for physical transformation. The Buddhist mantras are used to give you an experience of nirvana, and they're very effective, passed on directly by a Buddhist master to a disciple, but they're not for the purpose of spiritual transformation of the body. So Sri Aurobindo and the mother represent a new line of evolution and a new utilization of the principle of mantra. There are plenty of Tibetan Buddhists who've been receiving instructions from spiritual masters subtly for 1,000 years, and it's a well-known tradition. But it's about a kind of spiritual development that is itself unique. And because it uses mantra, it's closely related, in my view.
Before Sheldrake, there was already a theory that there is a general soul of animal and a general soul of plants, and there is a general soul of species of animals. Do you consider this idea that it could be...
Well, I was hoping with with Aristotle, I started out this evening hoping that we would try to answer the question, what is soul, but we didn't get there. So next week, we will start with the question of soul, psychic being, ideal forms, and the relationship between spirit and matter. Glad you enjoyed it.
Even if you weren't so good.
I thought last week was better. But I had no idea where it was going to go tonight. I have three different things set up here, and it's sort of somewhere between two of them. But I really had no idea, really, where it would go. So here we are. We covered the subject from a different angle, slightly.
So many fantastic questions.
Must have been guided by something
visible. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.